another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we bring you a forum recorded November 17, 2005 at Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. The forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002 and now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House. And Reggie Gordon was formerly the director of Homeward, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way and source of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also speaking will be Greta Harris, the senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits that seek to build housing for lower-income people.
Homelessness started in Richmond around 1974. Prior to 1974, in Richmond, Virginia, cities all across the United States, we had a different kind of way we managed or handled people who were not able to live on their own. My stepfather, I'm from Richmond. My stepfather is from Richmond as well. He grew up in Churchill. He's now 81, 82 years old. And when I started working with Homeward back in 1998, he recounted what happened in his family with an uncle who was an alcoholic. So this was in the 50s, 60s, 70s here in Greater Richmond. The uncle lived and died with that family. But this is his routine. He lived with his sister and her children, including my stepfather, in Churchill. He would get up in the morning. She would prepare breakfast for him. He would leave, go drink, stumble back in around noon. She'd have lunch ready. After lunch, he'd leave, drink, come back in for dinner. Dinner was ready. He'd go out again and then come back in the evening, any hour. He had a room. That was where he lived. He lived, and that's how he died. Other stories prior to the 70s. Say you had a sister or a relative who was a victim of domestic violence, maybe in Richmond or some other part of the state. This happens all over America, actually. When that happened, your sister and her children would probably pack up and find somewhere to roost with their extended family. Say you had a relative who had a mental health challenge. Somehow, in the extended family, those persons were absorbed into the household. So, what we think occurred is around the 70s, due to the economy and maybe a different way to look at family, those uncles and cousins and sisters, we were no longer able to manage them in our households. As a result, they were turned to the streets, or they turned to the streets. Now, we had seen this once before in America in the 30s, when the economy took a nosedive, people weren't able to maintain their housing and their jobs, Great Depression, soup lines, brother, can you spare a dime? We responded. If you recall, that lasted for a while, and we leveled back out. So when it occurred in the 70s, I wasn't working in this issue, obviously, back then, but when it occurred in the 70s, the congregations in our community and probably elsewhere across the United States responded. That's when we opened temporary soup kitchens. We've done it before. Temporary cot programs to help people, this mass of people who were showing up in our community. We've seen it before. We responded. It worked. We're trying the same formula again. So, that happens in the 70s. It doesn't end in the 70s. We're moving to the 80s. At that point, these uncles and cousins and aunts had really become nameless, faceless people who were on the streets, the homeless. There was a national outcry in America during the 80s about how do we respond to these thousands of people all across our country who seem to not be able to merge back into society or merge back into a family. During those days, you may recall Mitch Snyder, who did some hunger protests and fasting on the lawn outside the White House. And he was effective at raising national attention to this crisis, so much so that dollars began to be realigned at the federal level in order to help address this travesty in America. So those congregations that had started those meals programs and COTS programs became 501c3 organizations and became a network of nonprofit groups to address the challenges being faced by people who were called the homeless. We moved through the 80s. The issue does not subside. In fact, the numbers continue to grow. There are more and more organizations who are responding to this crisis in America. On top of that, the drug culture becomes infused with this crisis. So you have nameless, faceless people who don't have a place to live, who now appear to be drug addicts, very scary kind of individuals. In cities across the country, as well as here in Richmond, the economy responded to that. For instance, for sake of argument, people were afraid to come to urban centers because of the fear of interfacing with the homeless on the street. You wouldn't want to go to Tallahassee or Millen Roads and have to interact with aggressive panhandlers or step over someone. So fear became a part of this. So nameless, faceless people, drug addicts, scary. By 1985, here in Greater Richmond, there was a task force that was created in order to address this issue because, as you can imagine, it was on the radar screen for the business community, the nonprofit community, the faith community, neighborhoods, you name it. Unfortunately, by 1985, it had become politically and racially charged, to be quite honest. You're having a discussion by 1985 about who are these people and how do we get rid of them or face this issue. The task force that was created was comprised of about 35 members. I think Bob, this predates me too, but I think Bob and George Musgrove and city leadership at that time thought it was critical to have this kind of dialogue. Some of you, I think a couple of people in the room may have been involved with those discussions, and I've heard they were brutal, because when we started peeling back the layers to have this discussion, all of the negative comments and perceptions and misperceptions about this crisis just came right to the top. Very tense meetings, secret meetings, chairs being thrown, attorneys getting involved. In fact, at that point, the homeless themselves were trying to defend their right to become a protected class, saying that we are the homeless, and here is our legal representation to preserve our right to sleep in Monroe Park, to preserve our right to get free food, to preserve our right to, live in this country the way we have to. So, of course, that just didn't sit well with the business leaders in the room and maybe some other people who felt we want to help you navigate through this. That team, and I think Tim Kaine was on that team, looked at the from the perspective of what are other cities doing? This cannot be, and it is not, unique to Richmond. So they flew to two cities to look at what was going on. They went to New Orleans and they went to Columbus. And in both of those cities, what they recognized that same problems, same complication of stakeholders, but what those cities had that we did not have was a systems integrator or a overarching organization that tried to corral the work and the mission and the strategy of the now hundreds of organizations, congregations looking at the issue of homelessness. So they came back to Richmond and said, we need to create that kind of entity. The commission, that was the final recommendation of the task force. Of course, there was a dissenting opinion and threat of a lawsuit in order to prevent the creation of a coordinating organization, because the argument was, we need more money. We need more money for the programs. We don't need another layer of bureaucracy in order to help us navigate through this issue. The answer is more shelter, more food, places to live. Well, the majority ruled, and the entity was created, and the entity is Homeward. So that's when I come into the picture. I started with Homeward in 1998. Homeward was, a piece of paper that said we need to create a way to coordinate this work in Greater Richmond. Just getting back to town, I had no idea about how volatile the discussion had been. And I have to tell you, my first few weeks on the job, I was literally cursed out at meetings because the fact that we were coordinating the process was not welcome news to many, not only just some of the homeless advocates, but some of the providers, because we were in a climate of trying to find money to keep our doors open. In the 80s, with Mitch Snyder, the money flowed. In the 90s and leading up to Homeward, the money was dwindling, and there were turf battles about my people and my agency, and there wasn't a lot of communication. So what we did when we got started was go right for the facts. I hired a guy that was a research and data analyst, and we counted to find out, were there 6,000 people sleeping on the streets of Richmond, and that's why we had this issue, or was there something else that was more hopeful? And the good news is, after counting, we found that on any given day in Greater Richmond, back then and still probably to this present day, there are about between 1,600 and 1,400 people in this crisis, not 6,000. This is a medium-sized city. It's not New York. It's not San Francisco. New York, 35,000. In Richmond, 1,400, 1,600. So with these hundreds of organizations and concerned citizens, we felt, wow, this has been around since the 70s, but now this is, it's a different dialogue now, and it's probably solvable. So that sent us on the trajectory of looking at how do we bring the appropriate stakeholders together in order to find short and long-term solutions. The challenges were significant because homelessness had become institutionalized. We had agencies and boards and staff and misperceptions about the crisis. One of the documents that you have in front of you is a snapshot on individuals and families who are in a housing crisis in Greater Richmond. This gives you an idea of, after these years of research, what we now know about who is homeless in Greater Richmond and why. On any given day, there are 1,400 sheltered and unsheltered people. That means, let me just clarify something, that means that most of the persons who are quote-unquote homeless are in shelter, transitional housing, supportive housing, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Then that means of those who are not in emergency shelter, we actually have to use a scientific methodology to guess who's on the street. And we usually end up around 200 or so. And of those 200-300 folks, then a percentage of those are visible. But ironically, over these past 20 years, the person with the sign represents homelessness. But we know that is probably the smallest percentage of the people that are in this crisis. Maybe they're not even in the crisis. Maybe they're just on the street holding up a sign to get money. 68% of the adults are males, 34% are females. You see the racial breakdown, which reflects, I think, the urban area. 71% African American, 27% white, less than 2% are Hispanic. The mean age is 41, so you have 41-year-old black males. 49% have a high school education or GED. 23% above that have had some college, 8% have a bachelor's degree, so relatively educated black males in their 40s, 21% of veterans. That next bullet is the one that is startling. That's what doesn't fit. 63% have served some time in jail and or prison. Now, fast-forwarding this conversation, because I know you all are here because you really want to jump into it, you know, in the past, we just learned this. When we started in 1998, 1999, we weren't clear on all of these facts. We fine-tuned the data analysis to get down to what's peculiar about the people who are in this crisis. This is what's peculiar. You know, people in poverty, struggling to make ends meet, okay. But 63% of the people in our system having some criminal background, then it begins to make sense. If you have a felony, how are you going to, first, some doors are closed because of for employment. Some doors are closed, a lot of doors, for public benefits, for housing, you know, you name it. So you have someone that's getting more and more dejected, depressed, hopeless, maybe even trying to get back on the right track, but the options are limited. So, thankfully, we have shelters and meals programs to help them, but that should not be, in my opinion, where we expect them to live the rest of their lives. Because if that's the case, when we lock someone up, we're saying, we're going to take care of you for the rest of your life. You know, you'll serve your term, your time in jail, could be 15, 20 years, but of course your support system will have evaporated, or maybe it was negative. When you return to your community, we'll have shelters for you and meals programs, and so you have a place to go. So, I mean, that's why we have learned this is a systems integration approach. It's not homelessness. That really is a criminal justice system challenge. So I'll get more into the housing options, but I just wanted to give you a teaser as to how we began to process what are the appropriate housing solutions for people in our system. Greta, if you can just describe what you do and how you feel about housing in Greater Richmond.
This is Homespun C-SPAN on WRIR. Today you're hearing Reggie Gordon and Greta Harris speaking at the November 17, 2005 Leadership Metro Richmond Forum called Deconstructing Homelessness.
Well, good afternoon. Our organization is in the community development business and is related to but different from what Homework is trying to accomplish. And if I can just do a little quick historical context, similar to Reggie, but on a different path. If you go back to after World War II, and we had returning vets that were coming back to this country, and the federal government was providing, through the GI Bill, lots of resources to help our veterans get sort of anchored back into non-war society. There was this new development that was starting to occur, this thing called suburbs that were being created, and basically just new residential communities that were popping up all over the country outside of the urban centers where historically most Americans resided, unless you were out in rural America doing farming. And so when the suburbs were created, and it was, you know, part and parcel with the American dream of home ownership, that began the what we are seeing today still, the browning and pouring of American urban centers. What happened is that if you had the wherewithal to move up and out of those traditional urban neighborhoods, you did. And in the early 50s, early 60s, through the early 60s, there was tremendous white flight out of American cities. To help connect the new suburbs with where most of the employment opportunities were in the central city, there were these new highway bills that were created, and we had the new highway system, you know, 10-lane, 8-lane highways going through and across America. And when we had to determine where those new highways would go, inevitably they were located through the cheapest land areas, and they just happened to be generally neighborhoods, especially as they were coming into the inner cities, that were poor and generally comprised of residents who were people of color. And it happened all over the country, and here in Richmond you had the Carver, Jackson Ward, and what was the Navy Hill community, which is completely gone now, where 1,000 of our neighbors and businesses were completely destroyed to make room for I-95 coming through downtown. And that happened all over America. Simultaneously, I guess in the, let's get up to the early 70s, there was another series of flight coming out of the urban centers to primarily black middle class residents were moving up and out. And so what you had left in the urban centers were people of modest means with modest educational levels and modest opportunities to improve their quality of life. On top of that, you had public policies that started to exacerbate the challenges that were starting to pop up in America's urban cities. You had things like urban renewal. So when the neighborhood started looking a little tired around the edges, the government would come in and say, this is too bad, and we're going to redevelop this area. And so we would wipe out sometimes whole blocks. And I spent many of my early professional years in Philadelphia and New York, and I mean, we're talking whole blocks as far as you can see that were completely just bulldozed over, and sometimes the rubble stayed there for decades at a time without being rebuilt. Other times there were just vacant lots that were allowed to grow up with the grass as tall as I am, with vacant refrigerators and mattresses and dead bodies and stuff that would just hang out there as a dumping ground. You also had the creation, this was back up to the 50s, of public policy, which was public housing that was built initially as temporary housing for people who ran into a little bit of trouble. It was never supposed to be perpetual housing. It was to help people who were having a little crisis and then get back on your feet and go on. And inevitably, the public housing warehoused very poor people that were in need of some support services. And inevitably, those public housing developments were located in neighborhoods generally of modest means and generally made up of people of color. And again, another example would be in the Churchill or East End area of the city of Richmond. 50% or 2,000 units of all of the public housing in the city of Richmond is located in one neighborhood. And what that equates to is about, I would say probably about 7,000 or 8,000 people with household incomes of less than $8,000 a year that are living in one neighborhood. So the socioeconomic impact, not only on those residents, but on the broader community where that public housing is located, has ripple effects in an adverse way. And so I think with all of the frustrations between the public policies that were going on, the private disinvestment that was also happening in those areas from primarily the financial services industry, banks, and insurance companies, would literally draw a red line around these neighborhoods and say, we will take your deposits, Mr. Businessman or Ms. Resident, but you live in an area that is too high risk for us to invest capital. So even if you wanted to start a business, even if you wanted to improve your home, you didn't have access to capital. So the private disinvestment, the public policies helped to create the situations that we're dealing with today. There were civil riots and unrest that occurred across America, Newark, L.A., Detroit, Washington, places burned because people were so frustrated with the inequities of what was going on. And out of that, in some ways, in the late 50s, early 60s, the civil rights movement was birthed. And as a lot of those organizing efforts to try to bring justice to large segments of our American community were coming into play, there was another movement that started in New York called community development. And that's where residents who were so put off by the lack of thoughtful public policy and private business interests said that if we want to make our community better, then we have to do it ourselves. And so it was very grassroots in its orientation, and it was trying to bring together the right people and ideas and resources to promote positive community change. One of the basic tenets of community development is that residents who are most impacted by what is happening or is not happening in a community should be at the table to help shape the future of that community. And housing is such a basic need and right within this country. And so while community development ultimate goal is to help improve the quality of life in these targeted areas, affordable housing is just one of many components that make up a healthy and viable community, which is what we ultimately are shooting for. So community development includes child care centers and business development and parks development and creating health centers and all sorts of healthy neighborhood and schools and things of that nature. All the things that we all take for granted when we look at not just buying a house or renting an apartment in a nice neighborhood. You're buying the whole package. You want to be able to feel safe walking down the street. You want to be able to know that your investment in your home is going to appreciate so that it can be a source of equity for you and your family going forward. out of this whole movement of community development came a new set of nonprofits called community development corporations. And ultimately, they are our customers at LISC. We help them build their business capabilities to be able to produce quality, scale development that meets the needs of targeted populations that we try to serve. Reggie and I have known each other for a number of years, and his world and my world are totally different. Even though we're both in the housing, if you use that as a broad umbrella for both of us, our work entails doing high-risk real estate development in an area where the market says we shouldn't go. If any of you are involved in real estate, you know location, location, location is the mantra of the day, and we go where the market says we shouldn't go, and we serve people that the market says we shouldn't serve. It doesn't make economic sense, but it certainly is the morally just thing to do, and it also is part of a broader economic agenda for any region that wants to be healthy and vibrant and wants to meet its full potential. As the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce is trying to attract new business development and to retain existing businesses in this area, people aren't just buying, you know, a place to locate their headquarters. They're buying the quality of life in a region. And so if you have healthy suburbs, or even if you have a healthy downtown, but your neighborhoods that sort of connect all of this are unhealthy, and you have people that are homeless on the street, or if you have housing prices that are too high, that's going to make new investors or even existing people think differently about whether or not they want to stay and whether or not the quality of life is good here. For the housing that we helped to develop in over the last 15 years, collectively our partners have developed about 3,000 units of quality housing, both rental, homeownership, senior housing, special needs housing. But I would dare say that most of the housing that we develop is the folks on the list that Reggie described are not eligible to come stay with us, mainly because we run our operations as any for-profit business would do. This is a business that we're in, even though it's a compassionate business. And when we have rental facilities, we need people to pay the rent so that we can pay the mortgage that we've used to develop the facility. If we are able to provide someone with an opportunity to buy a home, then they have to have income in order to pay the mortgage so that they can retain that investment. We do criminal checks on people when they come in to, you know, apply for an apartment or to buy a home. And if you have a criminal record, you will not be approved to be able to come into our housing. We are about rebuilding neighborhoods, and we want our families that are coming into these facilities to be seen as good neighbors and good stewards. And we have concerns about the population that Homewood serves, about because it doesn't fit in nicely with our message of that we're rebuilding neighborhoods that are economically integrated, that are racially integrated. And it's a gap. There's an economic gap more than anything else, and maybe there's a criminal element gap that we have to overcome. Economically, we're probably about, I would say, $8,000 to $10,000 between the income of what your typical family would earn and how low we can reach on the economic spectrum to make the numbers work for the development that we do. And then on the criminal background issue, I have no idea how to resolve that because, again, we're pushing our partners to be good business people, and I think there needs to be some discussion about the concessions that we make given someone's criminal background and whether or not we bring them into one of our facilities. I will tell you that, you know, again, there's a tough love mentality in the work that we do. We're trying to save the whole, and then sometimes individuals may need to be sacrificed for that. And an example would be that in a multifamily development, if an individual in your household is selling drugs or is getting into trouble, there will be at least one attempt to try to work with that household to address whatever issue is going on that would drive that person to do an illicit activity. But if that can't be resolved, then the whole family gets booted out. And that saves, the overall development. So it gets very complicated. I would say that, you know, in this whole issue, when we saw the results or the impact of Hurricane Katrina, and especially in the New Orleans area, but throughout the Gulf Coast, if there was any silver lining that came out of that whole thing is that America was exposed for one of our Achilles heel issues as a country. And the poverty that is so present here and in every other corner of America, and the color of that poverty became front and center on our TV screens, at least for a hot minute. You don't see it that much anymore, not even follow-up stories. But for a short minute in our history, people got to see the face of poverty. And it wasn't just a New Orleans problem, and it wasn't just a Baton Rouge problem. It's a Richmond problem. It's an American problem. And I think when we start talking about the difficulties of how do we solve our housing crisis or our homelessness crisis, it's about how much are we willing as a society to share a little bit of what we have all together so that others of our neighbors can have a better quality of life. And especially other neighbors who may be a different color, or neighbors who may have a different educational attainment, or neighbors who may not be able to articulate their feelings and their thoughts as well as others, or those that may not be pretty in that they have a criminal record or they have an addiction issue. We are the wealthiest country in the world, and yet and still way too many of our neighbors are hurting. And I think, in a nutshell, people don't care. I think there are a lot of people who do care, but they don't care enough. And society is hard these days. You know, we have the kids, we got the job demands, we're commuting back and forth, and sometimes all we can do is just look out for ourselves and try to keep our own nose above water. But I think that we would improve as a people, our humanity, and as a society, if we could just give up a little bit so that others could gain a lot.
Homelessness is when all of this fails. The issues that Greta just mentioned, the easy way out is to say, well, it's too hard to figure out how to close that $10,000 gap for scores and hundreds and thousands of people. So thank God we have the shelters and we have meals programs. And at Thanksgiving, it used to drive us absolutely crazy the way the phone rang off the hook, because people tuned in and cared for about a week. Well, between Thanksgiving and Christmas. You know, I'd have to help the poor people. And we would say, the last thing we need is more people to serve turkey. And they would say, I have one day to do this, and you better find me a place to serve turkey. Meanwhile, this is the dialogue. And I'm sure that's why you all are here. This is how we need to move all of this conversation to this level. Minimizing homelessness. Homelessness is when all else fails, we'll have a little homeless services system. Day in, day out in Richmond and across America, this is how we need to change our communities to stabilize our citizens so we don't have the images again, which could happen tomorrow, that we saw with Katrina when a natural disaster happens. Imagine if Philip Morris closed or, you know, some FFV, I mean, it's closing. There are people who are living on the edge, but are now paying their rent, paying their mortgage, have kids in school. But when the bottom drops out, the only safety net right now is to turn to the shelter system. I hope we're smart enough and compassionate enough to figure that out.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we brought you a forum recorded November 17, 2005 at Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. The forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002 and now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House, who was also formerly the director of Homeward, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way, a source of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also speaking was Greta Harris, a senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits to seek to build housing for lower-income people.